You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
So Drew, it's great to meet you. Thanks for joining the show today. This is the first time that we have someone on who's sort of true CPG background. So it's going to be interesting, exciting to dig into your experience and how that view of brand changes, not only through the lens of CPG, but also in working with huge brands and small brands. Maybe just
I'm excited
that
to
as
be
a great
here.
Way to get started.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So talk a bit about your background and what it's been like, maybe that contrast of working with big brands and small brands within one of these big conglomerates?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, first of all, my background is I came out of school with a marketing background. My goal was to go make all the marketing changes in the world and solve all the world's problems. And of course, that doesn't always work as a marketer, but I was able to land starting off in pretty big organizations. So Lever Brothers, what it was known when I was with the organization, now Unilever, of course, in the US, and then Colgate-Palmolive, and working on really big, massive global brands. And of course, when you're working on those kind of brands, they're really a machine, right? I mean, if you think about the Procter & Gamble's, the Unilever's, the Colgate-Palmolive's, any of these big organizations, they're a machine that have been doing it really well for a long time. And so you tend to be, as a marketer, I would say you learn these beautiful basics, building blocks of a building. That's a great place to start off as an organization and learn those. But you tend to be moving the peanut a little bit at a time. And there's nothing wrong with that. You just have to know that that's kind of the position of what you're there for. I think for me, I've been a little bit lucky that I've worked for some big organizations, but at the same time, I've had a chance to really do some brand transformations. So some brands that probably were pretty weak and struggling, and I had a chance to really work on them and hone them.
I was having a conversation with a friend who comes from CPG, the world of CPG, a while ago. And we were talking about the difference between when you work in brand marketing at a CPG versus companies where you think about the corporate brand role, whether it's financial services, technology, other industries. And he sort of summed up the difference by saying, when you're in these other industries, marketing and brand is often fighting to have a seat at the top table. And in CPG, the marketing decides who comes to the table.
That's a great analogy. And I would say that my experience has been similar. I've been working for quite some time in a very financially driven organization in CPG. So in the world of CPG organizations, we definitely follow that world, but we definitely drive the business, right? At the end of the day, brand DNA, what you look, feel, smell like, what the advertising and messaging you're doing, what the innovation is that you're doing, the brand experience you're putting together. Fundamentally, you're driving that business and you're working closely, of course, with all of your cross-functional partners, but we're all working to do the same thing, which is to build that product and get that product onto a shelf or in e-commerce or online or wherever virtual shelf it would be. So it is definitely driven by marketing for sure.
Maybe talk about some of the similarities and the differences, how you think about brand in a CPG compared in other industries. I don't think it's some of the main fundamental principles still apply, but maybe talk about what is different. How do you think differently?
Maybe I'll start by saying what I think is the same, which is, to me, brand purpose is the same everywhere. Not what your brand purpose is, but the idea of having brand purpose. Now, that's become quite a buzzword over the last 5 to 8 years, right? Everyone has to have a brand purpose. Everyone needs to have a heart and a center. But fundamentally, in any world that you're marketing, you need to understand, what is the consumer tension? What is the reason for being? How does your product or brand or service help? And how you're actually helping someone along their journey that they want to lean in to be part of you. And to me, that's the same everywhere. I don't care what you're marketing. You can be marketing people, you can be marketing financial services, or you could be marketing toothpaste or deodorant on the shelf. I think that that's critical no matter what, because otherwise you're just someone out there that's picking whatever the latest and greatest is and running around in circles. And then people have a hard time choosing you. I think some of the areas that are probably different is how close you get in CPG to people. The reality is to do CPG, or at least my experience, is you really need to be in people's homes. You need to be in their bathroom, in the cabinet, spending time in their living room, depending what your product is, or in their kitchen. And you really need to spend time with people. You can't take guesstimates because you'll always be wrong. And a lot of times, I think in some brands, you have the ability to bring people in and maybe do a qual in a room, 5 or 10 people. But in CPG, I don't think you can get away with that. I don't think you can do that. You get group speak and people, you just don't get the real life of what's actually happening for people. Think about the world that we're in. We like to show our certain face. I'm wearing a shirt today with a collar and looking this way, and this is what I'm trying to express. But the reality is, who I really am is when I'm off of camera and I'm not Facebooking or whatever else I might be doing or Instagramming. And that's the piece where I think CPG really matters.
Yeah, this is my special podcast only hoodie that I'm wearing today. Yeah, I wear something completely different.
I'm often wearing a hoodie as well, but I thought, you know, I'm going to be on video today. I'm not used to that. I better bring a collar out.
So for anyone that's listening on the audio version, the last 20 seconds were a complete waste of time for them. I think your story about the ethnographic piece and being in the home with consumers is a really interesting one. Can you share any specific stories or insights from your career where you've been in a home, something that you have then observed that has then led to either not just even the position? It'd be great to talk about something that then might have been an insight that informed the brand or the marketing. But it would be even more interesting anything that actually influenced maybe innovation or packaging, something more fundamental than just the brand and marketing itself.
Yeah, I have millions of them. I've been fortunate enough to work on enough businesses that, and in a world that supports you really getting on the ground and spending time with people. And again, let's not forget, we're people too, right? So like, what do I do and how would I do it? And how does my family do things? But I'll give you a great example. So I was working on an underarm protection brand for a period of time, and I was doing, I would say, pretty traditional things, right? We were coming up with innovation. We were doing the testing against that. We had formulations. We would put those things in traditional tests on saying, what's the right claim? And of course, what do you get when you talk about underarm protection? The story is 12% better sweat protection or 26% better sweat protection. And when you're in the marketing and innovation world, you think you just uncovered gold, right? Like, I'm going to be 23% better sweat protection than they're going to be, and people are going to want me. And the testing proved that it's okay. But what you realize is I learned from it. I launched that and it was a failure. And what I realized was, is that by going and spending some time with people, we decided to do, let's not do quals in a traditional way. Let's not do what we normally do. Let's not go bring 10 or 15 people in a room and ask them what they think. Let's actually go spend time with 5 or 6, and happen to be a male underarm protection brand. Let's go spend time with 5 or 6 guys in real life, wherever they're at. So I'm from Wisconsin originally. So we were in the Midwest and we decided to go, and people were going to go, this guy was going to go do bowling. Great. Let's go bowling. Let's go spend some time and I'll bowl with you. Let's go bowl and let's do it. And we start talking and bowling. And of course, I start asking questions like a marketer does about how do you care about your underarm protection? And when are the times that you get nervous and anxiety and you need it? And of course, he's telling me the story of what every guy says, I don't get nervous. I don't have anxiety. I don't really care about those kind of things. They don't bother me. I'm great. Then we invite his friends over and we're all bowling together and his friends come over. And then I start saying, hey, Joe over here, or Scott or Susie or whoever it may be, he's telling me that he doesn't get nervous and worry about it. And what does all his friends do to him? Tell the truth. Oh, Joe's never asked anyone out on a date in his life. He's so afraid of it. You should see him. He's been wanting to ask so-and-so out. And every time we see him, he gets a hot, sweaty, this. Oh, wait a minute. So those moments matter to you, right? Great. Well, what happens in that moment? Well, you get hot, you get sweaty, you get stinky. That's the moment that matters and people care about when it comes to underarm protection. Someone doesn't care if they're sweaty on the court or in the gym. Someone doesn't care if they're 13% better sweat protection. What you start to realize in this kind of world is, wait a minute, we're real people who choose brands who feel like us and look like us. And that's what we're looking for. And so you can imagine if you go through the brands of men's underarm protection, there's a brand that stands for rugged masculinity. There's a brand that stands for amazing on the courts. And we needed to think about who our brand is and what does it stand for. And then I know I'm going a long way to get to your question, but if you get to the end of it, when you are able to articulate that specifically, why choose us as a brand, that then drives what my packaging should look like, what my innovation needs to be, what my formulas need to be, what my form might even need to be, the colors that I use and how I bring it to life. And guess what? And I would say everyone, so guys, gals, anyone in between and around, they don't really care what 13% better sweat protection means. That's marketing speak.
I love the story, but I don't think we finished it yet. You got to bring it home for us, Drew. So then based on that insight, tell us, what did this actually lead to? Did it lead to a new product innovation, or was it an insight that drove the brand story for the existing product?
Yeah, I would say that was the first time that as an organization, we embraced completely stepping back and spending time developing a real brand purpose, putting it onto paper. Who are we? What's the tension that's in consumers' lives? A real tension, like not 13% better sweat protection, a real consumer tension. We spent a ton of time teasing that out, then figuring out why our brand would even matter. Now, again, no one is going to use our underarm protection and then all of a sudden save the world. That's not what's going to happen. But I can give them a little moment in that moment that matters to feel comfortable, teasing that out. So to bring it home, we reset completely who our brand is, what is our brand purpose, what are we trying to do. That led to a completely different brand personality. I shouldn't say completely different, that's unfair, but a much more refined brand personality, a new innovation line. So we had an entire new line of products that came out built off of just for that. And probably the most important, the brand experience. The story that we brought to life was completely different than any story we've been bringing together in years around underarm protection.
To touch on that, when you talk about brand experience in that context, are you still referring to like how the experience feels through comms, or because again, we're talking about a product brand, or was there a way to bring its life through a real life experience?
When I say brand experience, it's a kind of a catch-all for the words and the language we use. For me, it's comms is the easy one, right? At the end of the day, here's the story we want to tell and how we want it to come to life. But I would say a broader brand experience, which is how do you get people to interact with your product or try it or use it? And I guess we could relate this to comms, but when people hear comms, they often think like a TV advertisement or whatever else, or nowadays a poster, a video. But what we really spent time on is where does someone really interact with our products and our brands and can experience it in a real way? How do we find those moments? And what we started calling, and you hear this a lot now, the moments that matter. Where are the moments that matter that really hit somebody? And for us, what we found in underarm protection, it's not at the shelf, right? It's not at the shelf. It's not making sure that the right POP is sitting there. It's not hitting someone up with a TV advertisement for 30 seconds and telling them that. What we realized is reminding someone in those moments where they're on the subway commuting into work and they're sitting in that kind of environment, or they're going to the friend's wedding, or they're going to such and such event. It's those kind of moments, which I know sounds still very traditional, but it's amazing how little people actually spend in those moments bringing their brand to life to really get a true brand experience. Think about wafting the fragrance of a certain individual product across a concert, where people actually do kind of care about who they're standing next to and what they smell like in those moments. How about bringing across that the smell, that the fragrance, the beautiful fragrance that you have, or the musk or the smell or whatever it would be. How about wafting that across in a open concert so people are smelling it and realizing it, and then linking to it some advertising that says, hey, this is what you're smelling and realizing, like, this, think what this could do for you. And again, that sounds very old and traditional, but think how different that is versus, hey, you know, that smells good. We do that with fragrance all the time.
Did you do that at a concert?
We did.
What's the machinations of actually getting that done?
Yeah. No, it's massive. So we worked with the fragrance houses, of course, who are masters of this kind of thing. Again, CPG, if you think about it, we often get brought down into these traditional pieces, but the reality is we're working with super inspirational and forward-thinking organizations such as fragrance houses, right? Fragrance houses are doing this every day. with perfumes and colognes. And so one of the things they're great at, right, is thinking about a store. When you walk into a store, I can't name brands, but think about walking into a certain skincare brand store or a certain home care brand store, and there's a smell you get. And it's that smell or that fragrance that you lean into and you're like, this is for me. So we worked with them and said, okay, you do this in a store, you do this in a pop-up. How do we do this in a concert with 30,000 people? And what we brought to life was a series of the same kind of machines that basically waft that fragrance or that smell or the tones underneath it in multiple different places at different times when the music was changed. Now, it happened to be, it was less of a concert and more of a DJ of mixing music, but still a concert. And we played closely with that DJ and their producers that had the right music. So just like you see the lights going off, you would get the fragrance whiffs that would come in the same way. And then you link it to the messaging. And then we can do that nowadays by targeting people on their phone, right? How many people have their phone out taking a recording of it? How many are posting on social media? Now I can hit them up right exactly at that moment and say, do you like what you smell? Or do you know what you're smelling? This is what it is. You could be this smell, you know, that type of messaging.
Through targeting people, through geofencing technology, where you're targeting people at specific locations?
That's exactly right. And of course, as you know, nowadays, the magic is that you can catch people basically wherever they are. And again, if you do it right, you're not being intrusive or obscene about it, right? You're linking in a message to people that care. And you're not serving it to everybody that's sitting in the concert. You're serving it to the people that you've learned from and you've targeted and you've had some reactions to it. And so those type of interactions for us is what I would say is true brand experience. And you don't really think about this as CPG usually, right? People always think like, hey, this is old stuffy world. It's not. In fact, that's where I think the magic comes in CPG.
And it's great that you mentioned that it wasn't a specific artist, because in my mind, or maybe some of the people listening might have been thinking, hang on, when I was at a Taylor Swift concert, was that this campaign or was that just the person next to me who maybe had put on a bit too much?
And maybe both. Right? Because then part of it is, and again, I'm not really a big old school sampler kind of a person, and my light's turning off on me here. So give me a second. That tells you how I'm not moving enough. That's probably a first.
The
right?
Smart is home in action. The smart home in action.
Is that a first? We are all about sustainability here. I can tell you that.
Let's go back to the purpose conversation then, because there's been so much written about purpose. Let's talk about purpose done right. I don't know that there's an author who I love to read about who's sort of an Aussie Brit called Mark Ritson, who writes for Marketing Week. Yeah. And he's written some pretty scathing things about this over-indexation on purpose, especially in the worlds of CPG. It's like, just look, you're in the business of doing good strategy, good positioning, but this over-index on purpose, he's over-criticized a lot. So imagine that I'm him with less swear words. Like, how would you sort of respond to that?
Well, I might keep swear words in, but I actually agree with quite a few things that he says. Actually, the concept of it, which is that everyone has decided that brand purpose means emotion, means giant storytelling and being in the clouds. And everyone has moved to think that you need to go save the world from something. And that's the reason why people choose you. Now, there are brands that do that, and they deserve to talk about that. There are other brands.
Well, there's probably one, right? Patagonia is the one who can really authentically, it's in the business strategy.
And they're very, very good at it. But to me, what brand purpose does, if it's done right, is it keeps the guardrails on who you are and why you do what you do. And it keeps marketers and it keeps customer development and it keeps everyone on the ship understanding that this is my framework. What I always say about brand purpose is brand purpose is fundamentally an inside facing document to me. Brand purpose is not talking to someone and telling them about your brand purpose. If I tell you about my brand purpose, you don't care. You don't need to. It's our brand purpose. What they should feel is our brand purpose. And this to me takes it away from this way up in the clouds and lands the plane. One of the things that I talk about with my teams, if it's the China team, if it's the US team, if it's the global team, any of the teams that I work with day in and day out. So the brand purpose and the brand experience reports to me, which is brand DNA, innovation reports to me, a lot of the markets report to me. And what I would say is, I always say, you have to be able to talk about why our brand has the right to play in this place, why we have a right to win, And most importantly, how are you going to land the plane? Because fundamentally, someone does need to buy you. And I think that's the piece that a lot of marketers lose. I think they love doing brand purpose in the clouds. And you love it. And then you want to tell people about that brand purpose. When actually, back to your quote of our friend, which is, if you only stay up in the clouds, then as a real person, and I'm sitting there and I say, let's go back to underarm protection. I just want underarm protection that actually is going to protect me in the moments that I care about. Like, that's what I need. Stop telling me that you're going to go save the world.
So let's talk about this specifically then into the brand that you're leading today. So we're talking about LTMD. It's part of Colgate-Palmolive, but there's probably a lot of people that don't know what LTMD. Maybe talk a bit about that. And also, when you think about what might drive that, what might move the needle at Colgate-Palmolive, what's the role in the broader portfolio of having a smaller brand like this?
So first, let's talk a little bit about LTMD because most people don't know it. LTMD is the number one used, recommended, and sold professional sunscreen brand in the United States. And so it's primarily used, recommended, and sold from dermatologist offices. So it is a cosmetically elegant, beautifully made skincare product. So it's a protection brand, and sun protection is the fundamentals behind it. But also we have a series of restoring products that bring your skin back to normal. But think of it as not gloopy messes at the beach. It's a pure skin cancer play, which is extremely important, by the way. We do that too. But it's not gloopy mess at the beach. This is, I have a skincare routine and I want to protect my skin from those aggressors. But I also want to make sure that I am protecting myself from anti-aging and from aging, because the sun is the number one aging of our skin and those areas. So that's what our brand is. It's about protection and restoring and bringing that to life. And it's a very small brand. We're only in a handful of markets around the world. And if you think about a company as big as Colgate-Palmolive, we're in over 200 countries. Why buy Elta, I guess, is your question. Why buy LTMD? One of the things that makes brands like LTMD magic, which is something that Colgate really, really believes in, is it's easy to get caught up in Colgate and think it's just a CPG product selling or CPG brand selling CPG products. But Colgate is magical in the way that we use technology, innovation, and bring it to life. Partnerships with the profession. Our oral care products are not just to be marketed. It's real technology, real innovation. We have huge R&D resources, and it is not just deliver a different flavor. It's to deliver things that really change the way that the product works and helps you in a healthy way. And we bring it to life through the profession. So dentists and hygienists around the world. Colgate-Palmolive owns Hill's Science Diet Pet Food, which most people don't know. Also, very scientific, brought to life through who? Veterinarians. The profession is important. And so we've moved into a journey with Colgate-Palmolive that we think is an analogy of those, which is bringing it to life in what we call skin health. And that brings brands that are not hope in a bottle. This is not skincare hope in a bottle. Those brands are out there too. These are real brands with real innovation, real technology. When they say something, they're going to do it and prove it. And that's why it's loved by the profession, just like our oral care products and our pet food products and pet care. And so that's why we think we have a right as a Colgate-Palmolive to play there, because we think it matches and mirrors. And we're really early in the journey, right? These are small brands. They've only been owned by Colgate-Palmolive for a few years. Very different than 200 years in 200 countries.
Take us behind the scenes into getting to the purpose. Maybe first, what is that story and what was the process to get there?
So for us, and remember, the way that we vision, and I personally vision brand purpose, is it's an internal framework that allows you. So our brand purpose at LTMD is that everybody has the right to live freely under the sun. Now, that's a very high level purpose, right? Which is fundamentally, it's a brand about getting you outside and supporting you. And you don't have to worry about what happens when you do that. You don't have to worry about the sun or pollution or blue rays or free radicals. We're going to make it easy so you don't have to worry about it. We're going to protect you from those things and restore your skin. Now that's internal, right? I'm not going to say that line to anybody outside, including my wife or significant other, because she's going to laugh at me and she's going to be like, you're up in the clouds. But this is really what drives us internally to say, so what does that mean from a product standpoint? What do people expect from us? What is the innovation or the feel that people should have? What are the forms that we would bring to life? What that tells me is, let's use that purpose and bring it to life. I'll use a real life example of innovation. What that means is that I am open to, as a brand, bringing it to life, new forms that allow you to protect yourself in a simpler and easier way. So maybe thinking about sunscreens in a roll-on, or photo protection with antioxidants that by putting it in your skincare routine will help you better deflect the UVA and UVB rays of the sun. Those are all in scope because that's what my brand stands for. What my brand is not going to go do is, I am not going to address your acne or acneic skin because you have internal tensions that are driven and then the sun reacts to that and is causing you to have acneic. I'm not going to come fix your acneic skin. That's not right for our brand because that is not tied to who we are about living freely and going out and spending the day outside and doing what you want to go do and not worrying about it.
It helps give you a filter also for what not to do, because that's the essence of strategy oftentimes, right? It's the notion strategy isn't just we're going to do more. Strategy is making trade-offs about what we're purposely not going to do.
And I think that's the hardest part as a marketer. If I could choose one thing in my career that I wish I would have learned earlier, that's it. As a marketer, we believe we can do it all and we should. Just because you can sell a unit of something, or it's worth, pick a number. I don't care if it's a $1 or $1 million. At the end of the day, that doesn't mean you should do it. And as marketers, we love to try to just do everything. We just keep expanding and expanding. And next thing you know, your brand's, you know, I'm selling sun protection or photo protection or anti-aging. And now all of a sudden I'm launching lasagna. Right? I'm over-exaggerating that, but that's what happens, right? Is we all think it. And then the other piece is the next marketer that comes behind us onto the business thinks they need to add the next 10 things because, of course, that marketer didn't do it as good as I can do it. And so to me, brand purpose and focus is all about what we're not going to do. It is an unbelievably clear filter. Think about your technology team, your R&D team. They got the filter. Is this in or this out? Well, does it fit this or doesn't it? And because we're all real life people, if you take your company hat off for a second, you would say, well, would I buy this from this brand? Do they have a right to play there? And the answer most of the time, honestly, is no. The answer should be no most of the time.
How have you then taken that purpose and at least drawn a dotted line to then the external articulation? What does the brand house look like, the brand pyramid, whatever framework you use in order to then start to transition over to the external promise?
So some of the things that make our brand specifically special in that world of living freely is that it is amazingly cosmetically elegant. Now, what the heck does cosmetically elegant mean? What it means is that it is protection or photo protection, and you are able to put it on like a skincare product. It is not ruining your other skincare products. It plays nicely. It's not leaving you a white goopy mess so you don't want to be seen outside. It's not flaking off, balling up. It's none of those type of things. So you want to wear it versus I have to wear it. And so for us, if you think about our brand purpose and bringing it to life, if I want people to feel comfortable and to live freely under the sun and not worry about it, they have to want to wear it, not because a doctor tells them to. Now, I want, and a doctor does tell them to, and we are going to be the brand that protects you from UVA and UVB. But fundamentally, people were only going to wear it so long if I'm told I have to versus I want to. And so think about how that comes to life. So now back to your question, the forms that we put to life, I need to make it reapplication easy. So if I have skincare and makeup on in the morning and I'm going to go spend the day and I'm in the office and now I'm going to go outside in the afternoon or in the evening and I'm going to go have whatever you're going to do, meet up with some friends or social, and you need to reprotect yourself. I don't want to ruin my makeup. I don't want to ruin my other skincare. I need to have reapplication that's easy to put on. So I'll call it cosmetically elegant. So I need to have those kind of forms. That's the kind of thinking that we do and how we bring it to life. Now, to your storytelling, where does those things type really matter? those things don't matter really on the beach. The average person knows I need to protect on the beach. So I'm not bringing my brand experience to life, showing random people running on a beach, spraying themselves and frolicking in the water. Like, of course that is there. What I'm doing is thinking your day as you go on your commute and you finish your skincare, whatever that skincare routine is, if it's one product, only our product, or 60 products, whatever it may be, I'm linking you into getting ready in the morning and feeling great and confident when you walk out the door. And I'm going to help you support you in that journey. And when you get done at the end of the night, I'm going to help restore your skin back to where it needs to be because it's been attacked all day long. Yes, we've been protecting, but let's restore it. That's the kind of world that we show and we bring to life in our brand experience.
Is there a broader concept here when you think about skincare and you think about the importance of SPF as even another potential pillar of wellness? You know, for years, we thought of wellness really just as exercise, nutrition. And then I think it's one of the reasons why now, you know, there's such premium mattresses and beds now because sleep is that additional pillar of wellness. Is this one of those elements where it's not just for people who have very sensitive skin? And is this where maybe where the growth opportunity is more broadly, which is it's actually a change in overall consumer mindset that SPF should be part of everybody's day to day?
That's right. I love how you've linked
and,
that.
And I'm not being paid or sponsored to say that.
No, I honestly, I was like, all right, here's the $5. Like, I will tell you that this is exactly the link. There wasn't a lot of great things out of COVID. It was a horrible time for everybody, unbelievably painful time around the world. But there's one thing that I personally feel came out of it as a benefit, and that is people rethinking themselves, their healthcare, what matters to them as an individual, but also as a healthy body. Now, it doesn't mean that everyone goes to the gym for 5 hours. What it just means is you think about those things a little bit different than you used to. And SPF is that exact world. It used to be that we would scare people. We didn't as a brand, but sun care brands scared you into thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going to get skin cancer. I better protect myself. But yes, that is so critical. I will never back away from that. It's critical. But there's a healthiness to just being healthier overall in the things that you use to brush your teeth, the thing that you use in what you put on your skin, the way that you protect yourself from the free radicals and the UVA and UVB rays, the way and the things that you put into your hair to keep that as healthy as it possibly can. All of these things all ladder up to the larger idea, which is health and wellness. And this is not just a pitch. I don't talk a lot of brands on here, but Colgate-Palmolive, it's one of the things that I love about this company is that it all ladders to that. That's why the science, the technology, and real things and not hope in a bottle really matter to this company.
All right, so we've got to prove that this isn't a PR exercise for Colgate-Palmolive. We've got to get into the hood and maybe tell some of the stories of
some of the pain.
Got to bring some of the pain now, Drew. Talk to us about some of the things that haven't worked.
There is a lot of pain on the journey, right? In fact, I would say that my best learnings in life have been through horribly painful situations, either personal or work related, which is good to learning. You know, I talked earlier a little bit about underarm protection and some of the pain of learning that the hard way. I would say in the brand I'm on now, you know, one of the things that we learned is we hadn't articulated really who we were. It was in the minds of people. And because it was in the minds of some people, it was hard. And we did expand too far, too fast around too many products. And if you go across our portfolio, we have a portfolio of 40 some odd products today, right? So there's 40 some odd products. And we've had to do some heavy pruning. So where does the pain come in? Well, where the pain comes in is in the last 5 years, we've launched things and spent a ton of money on beautiful products that don't fit. We've launched products that would play in a space that I would call prejuvenation. So beautiful products that work, they're great products, but they're not right for our brand. And so we spent hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars developing these beautiful products and doing that, and then realizing too late that that's not right. That's not the place for us. That's not who we are, and that's not a place. And that's not how people look at us. And that, I would say, adds me to the second pain that is hard learning. You like to be everything for everybody. That's what marketers love to do. We love to say, I have this target, I have this target, I have this target, and I have this target. And I will say on this brand, that's where we started. who doesn't need sun protection? The answer is everyone needs it. So we lean in and we think as a brand, I need to talk to everybody. And we did that at first. And I would say that was probably one of the hardest and biggest learnings we had, is we spent a ton of resources and money trying to talk to everybody, because who doesn't need us, versus talking to the right groups that really matter, that can make a big difference in who we are. And they will then be the advocates to the next cohort and the next cohort and the next cohort.
Can you talk a bit about that core?
Yeah. So for us, you know, if I give you demographics, that's a very old school way to say it. I would say that we are spending time thinking about generally females, but it's not always female. Generally females, I would say, specific in the US, it would be generally females who have a skincare routine. So they're already using to some odd products, so that they're kind of in the skincare routine, what it would be. They're open to products that are beyond what we would call pharmacy brands. There's nothing wrong. Pharmacy brands are beautiful, by the way. I use many pharmacy brands myself, including in skincare. But people that are willing to maybe get for a little bit higher efficacy and some of the things that you can get from the profession in those areas, open to that kind of space and want to be healthier. This is the link to the point earlier about wellness, that fundamentally it's beauty in a way of being healthier. Being healthier delivers your beauty. Whatever that beauty is that you want it to be, having healthier skin and taking care of it will help you get there. It is not about hiding, remaking, and beauty in that sense. This is your beauty and how to go do it. And so for us, bringing that to life is extremely important. So that's who we're looking for. Now, it tends to be female. We have a whole group of males as well. It tends to be, you know, in this age range of 20s to 40-ish. Now, it's a long range, but remember, we're not actually grouping people by age. I'm not selecting targets because I'm going in and saying, I want 25 to 40-year-old females who do this. That's not. We're doing it the opposite way, which we're saying, hey, we're looking for people that use products like this, that are on this kind of journey, that have linked these kind of things, that ask these kind of questions. This is the kind of folks that we think we want to talk to, we think are the best. And of course, you test your way through that. That's where we think we can make a difference.
Yeah, it's a really interesting approach. It's, you sort of flip segmentation a little bit on its head, not in terms of what the outcome is in that persona, but in terms of almost like the screening, I'm going really deep here, like in terms of even the screening questions of how you might bring someone into the conversation.
That's right. For me personally, and there are probably brands, I don't know of any, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but there are probably brands that need to target that way, right? I don't know what they are. But for any brand that I've worked on, and especially the one I'm working on right now, the age range of someone or traditional demographics is not the driver of who's interested in my brand. As a marketer, we're so far past that. We're so far past that. We use that because we didn't have a choice before. There was no other option. But now we have information and data and people and understanding, and it allows us to actually be so much more targeted and personalized. Not a scary, freaky way, but more like, wait a minute, this is a brand that is interested in me, and I'm glad they're talking to me.
Drew, this is a fascinating conversation. I want to switch gears over to sort of a rapid fire wisdom round. What advice would you have given maybe to yourself sort of 15 years ago? And you can't use the, we believe that we would have done it, or you have to think of something else.
I'll tell you, ask questions. Early in your career, we love to think we've got this education, and then we come out of the education, we think we're really smart, and then we get into a company or a business and we start working on brands and we do something successfully. And then we think, look at us, look what we can do. And you start telling people what to go do. And I would say that I wish I would have learned that earlier. You need to ask questions.
What questions would you have asked?
I would ask, why did someone select what they use? And in fact, I'd go farther and not ask the question. I'd just go spend time with people. I'd see it, because if you ask the question, you probably don't get the right answer. So when I say ask questions, it's more like get external, spend time with people in their homes, in the bowling alley, wherever they may be, while they go shopping, and not traditional ways, and just listen and watch and observe And the more you do that, the more, what I'll say, asking questions you've been doing to sponge it in, and you start to realize and get the real threads of gold that you can pull out of that.
One of the best marketing books that I've read that actually isn't a marketing book. It was the only book that I read before I was going to become a father for the first time. And it's a book called Bringing Up Bebe, which was written by an American journalist who moved to France with her husband. And she was fascinated initially as to why French children didn't cry, why they ate three meals a day and didn't need a snack, why they were well-behaved at restaurants without their iPads, why when they were at the park, they would be playing with their friends and the fathers were having conversations on park benches with each other and didn't have to be playing with the kids. And when she went and spoke to French people to ask them, what is it that they did from a parenting standpoint meant their kids were so different? None of them could articulate what is it they did. Right. And so she had to adopt this ethnographic approach because people couldn't articulate what they did that was right. So different.
People don't know they're different because they're not different. I love using a line like every person thinks they're unique like everybody else. So you don't even realize what that is. And so when you ask the question, how does someone answer it? One of the greatest experiences I've had in my career is living internationally in different markets. And again, you can do that even in the US, just living in different states, being in different markets, spending time with different people than yourself and your close cohort. And you just start to open up to wide the world is and how everyone is unique, like everyone else, right, in that group. And you think you know, but you don't. And that goes back to the, again, I'm using a basic line, ask the questions, but I would say it's further than that. See and observe what people are doing. That is sponging that in and starting with the answer that you don't know. You think you do, you don't. You think you know why that person selected that, but you don't. How do you figure it out?
What are the innate traits that you look for when you think about your 2x2 talent matrix? And when you think about your top right box in terms of that high potential top talent, what are the criteria and things that those people have that set them apart from everyone else?
So there's four. I'm pretty specific on the four. So I've anally written these down. So I'm on it. And again, not everyone needs to fit this because you need a mix. But I would say I have found that around my career and hiring of individuals and building teams, that having a good mix of these individuals breeds success. And the first one is embracing risk. Someone that is comfortable leaning forward in the chair when there's a risky situation or something a little bit riskier, or asking the little different question that's there, or putting something forward that is not what everyone else is saying. So embracing risk. They have to show me that somewhere they've done that. Now, I don't mean go jump off a cliff. I just mean that they are open to the embracing of risk and they've shown that in their life, whatever it may be, or their career so far. Two, as you probably have heard a lot from me, getting external. I want to know that the people that I work with are natural in looking for real people, of being around real people, and my light going off to save energy again, but this natural getting external and not focus groups. Number three, when change needs to happen, it's up to you to drive change. I want to see people that have been change drivers, not flag wavers, not, oh my goodness, there's a problem. Who's going to fix it? Or we need to get everybody in the room and fix it. Yes, we do need to get everyone in the room, but I want to see people that drive the change when there's something that needs to be changed. And number four is people that recognize when something's magical and aggressively scale it. That's the other piece. When you find magic, because it's not always magic, it's rare that you find plutonium, but when you find it, you should do everything you can to scale it. So for me, the four, and it's been consistent for many years of my hiring practices and looking, I want to see people that embrace risk. I want to see people that are getting external in real life with real people. I want to see people that have drive change when there's a problem or an issue, not just to drive change, like there's a reason, and scale amazing when you see it. If you do those four things, I personally think you will be successful, marketing or not. Whatever you do, if you do those four things, you'll be magical.
Are there characteristics of what magic is and isn't?
That's a good question. And I think that's actually one of the hardest things of the four, right? How do people deliver against that, right? So if you're on the other side of an interview with me and you want to show these things off, finding out where those moments of plutonium to me are probably the hardest thing for someone to be able to do. Because if you jump too fast, you may have thought you found plutonium, but you actually just found dust, right? And so to me, part of that is back to embracing risk in moments and understanding when and the level of risk, right? I'm not talking about a free-for-all, but earlier in your career, you can embrace those moments that you think are magic, embrace that little risk that you have, and go after it. And you're going to fail, right? I mean, think about how many products make it to a shelf or digital shelf or a physical shelf, and how many fail. It's okay. It's about learning from that, which then you'll get better at finding out where those spots of plutonium are, recognizing those, and being able to go after them. I, without a doubt, I'm 25 years in the industry overall, 25 years. And I will say that I still have a hit rate that is not beautiful. I still fail consistently, but that's okay. I'm getting better every time at recognizing those moments.
What are some of the really important lessons for you for how to get the most out of agency partners?
They're very similar, to be quite honest with you, to some of the conversations we've been having along this journey. One, I'm not smarter than my agency. And I think as a marketer and someone who's brought innovation to life or developed the innovation or built this, you know so much of it and you think you are, you need to allow agency partners to do what they're magical at. I'm going to give you a really bad analogy or an example, but I really like when the plumbers plumb and the electricians do the electricity. And I know that I am not as creative as the creatives. That's what they're magical at. That's their sweet spot. That's who they are. I'm not as innovative as the innovators. I'm not a better planner than the media planners. So I'm using an agency like that type of an agency, but any agency. There's people who are magic and really good at what they're doing. Let them go do it. And to me, one of the ways that I try to, I'm not always great at it, but I try harder every day. And I try to instill this upon my team, which is when you give feedback on things to the agency, you should never pick more than two or three things ever. If you get anything, let's use creative. If they come to you with a creative idea and they lay it out after a brief and you have to give them more than two or three kind of feedback loop, then you've done something wrong. You briefed it wrong. You set it up wrong. You've gone too far. Just what are the kind of things that you're thinking about that might need to be worked on or the areas? And then let go, let the magic people go do magic.
So final question, what advice do you have when you think about criteria when you're choosing agencies? What are the things that you look for?
Well, the first one is I want to see groups that have a proven track record. Now, that doesn't mean they have to have 100 brands underneath them. In fact, I often find that cases sometimes stale, and not always, but sometimes is. I want someone to be able to, or an agency to be able to articulate, here's what we have learned along our journey. Honestly, just exactly the conversation we're having. Here are the mistakes that we've made, how we've learned from that, and here's the magic we'd then be able to create. Now I know you're a real person and you're not just going to show me fluff and fake and hide things. Now I know we're going to have a great relationship where you're going to come to me and say, hey, I want to take this risk. It's going to be a bet. You willing to bet on it with me? Let's do it. Or the opposite, which is we've made a mistake. It's okay. So for me, that's really important. And I would say the second one is that you have to have personal, and I don't mean personal, like what are you doing tonight for drinks, a personal relationships with your agency. You have to be able to talk about each other openly and have a conversation and what do you like to do? Where do you go? And so you really become personal. So it's not this walled kind of garden. And to me, that's when magic happens because you start to learn each other. You also then make feedback stronger because when you're having conversations, people start to learn and get each other. I don't think a lot of marketers, and I'm using marketers, but I don't think it's just marketers. I think it's from marketers to senior leadership to this. I think a lot of times we like to catch people. We want them to come in and present something over, and then we want to catch them on why they're wrong or question them on why that's done that way versus, hey, like we're in this together. Right? If we get this right, you win, I win, you get more business, we get more business, and fundamentally, people win. They want to lean into your brand and do more of it and get more of it. And guess what? That allows us to then create more and build more. Like, we're not in a competition. We're in this to win together.
at some point, I'm going to have to put a stop to this just because we could keep going for another hour. I'm so loving the conversation, but A, I don't want you to have to sit in the dark for the rest of the day.
Yeah, I know. We're saving energy and money. This is a good thing.
And B, somebody told me that podcast episodes should stay under 3.5 hours, which I'm doing my best to achieve because ultimately,
I thought it was 3 days.
If I was just recording it for myself, I'd happily sit down. But thank you so much for all of your insights and the time. It's been a fascinating conversation.
I really appreciate it. And as you can tell, one of the reasons I think we have a long conversation is I'm really passionate about this. I've learned a lot of hard lessons along the way. And not that I'm magical, I'm still learning hard lessons. And so I am always love the conversation and the thinking and always open to anybody reaching out and having conversations. And that's, I think, how we all get better and grow.
Thanks, Drew.
Thank you.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.